at the University Club at lunchtime. So you want to come, you're welcome to. The whole idea, though, is to bring your skeptical friends, Christian skeptics and non-Christian skeptics, to ask their questions. And I think they charge, no, outrageous $17, do they, for the luncheon? $16, okay. But you don't have to buy lunch. You can just come and participate if you like. There's opportunity for that as well. But if you do want to come and you do want the lunch, then you'll need to call our office, and so they can alert the kitchen people there that you want to do that. Well, I just came back from a rather exhausting but very fruitful and exciting trip to Florida, three cities in Florida. But when I came back, I found this sheaf of emails. These are emails I got from science professors who heard my remarks at Rick Smalley's funeral. And I did not realize that there were professors there from both the Netherlands and Sweden. We got some emails from them. I had no idea there were so many professors there who were Christians. But some of these emails I got from non-Christians who said they really want to start reading our books. So I'm really glad I made that trip to Houston to do that. And if you haven't seen the remarks, they are posted on our website, the remarks I gave at Rick's funeral. If you don't know who Rick is, he's a Nobel laureate in chemistry who came to Christ partly through reading several of our books. Another exciting email I got was from one of our volunteer apologists, Pat McGuire. He's an exploration geologist in Alaska, and he just sent me an email of a trip he made to China, where he took the Journey Toward Creation DVD. And, you know, we are bringing this out in a multi-language version, but he couldn't wait. He went ahead and did Chinese on his own and got into China, and he just sent us an email of how several people inside China came to Christ through watching the DVD. And, of course, now that it's out there in China, it's being pirated all over the place. So hopefully many more in China will get to see it. They'll probably even come back here. I mean, and the thing that really surprised me in my trip to Florida, well, one thing is how few people have heard about Reasons to Believe and how excited they were to find out that a ministry like ours exists. That was kind of the impression we got everywhere we went, is people really felt a sense of liberation discovering that there was a ministry like ours. But I don't know what it's been like here, but this past week, everywhere I was going in Florida, people wanted to talk about intelligent design. I mean, I guess it's really hitting the news lately, and lots of questions, and many different questions are coming up. And everywhere I went, I had to address those kinds of questions. So if you've got questions, I'll entertain them on that issue. But the two things that I think were responsible for generating a lot of the dialogue is a report that comes out of Australia, actually, about what the Vatican is deciding on intelligent design. And basically their position, I've got it here in print, is that the Vatican has decided to only defend the idea that God creates the universe, and that science needs to address all issues after that, that Christianity really does not address anything after the creation of the universe. It does make the point, though, that Genesis 1 teaches, quote, evolution, in the sense that it teaches that there's different things happening at different times, but makes no attempt to claim that the Bible offers any position on what happens when, where, and how. And basically it says, we need to let the scientists, the evolutionists, decide that for us. We're only going to stake our case on that there is a God necessary to create the universe. I find this personally disturbing because it's really pushing the position that if you're a Christian, you basically only need to defend a deistic interpretation of science, not a theistic or a Christian interpretation of science. And the difference, if you haven't recognized the term, is a deist believes there is a God, but as a God that creates the universe and lets the natural process that he set up in creating the universe do everything else thereafter. So it's a God that's not involved beyond the creation of the universe. So it's a God, from a personal perspective, you can't count on. He was active 13.7 billion years ago, and don't expect him to do anything for you today. And he hasn't been doing anything since that 13.7 billion years. The other thing that's caught my attention comes out of Kansas. Kansas kind of got the whole intelligent design at a political level started about 4 or 5 years ago. And, the board that voted in intelligent design teaching got voted out, but a new board's been voted in that's pro-intelligent design, and looks like they're going to be successful in getting some of their political objectives across. But an interesting response has come from the University of Kansas. They said, you want us to teach classes on intelligent design, we're going to do it, but we're not going to do it in the science classroom. We're going to do it in, what kind of classroom was it? Now, it's a class on American mythology. So they're saying, hey, you guys want to push us to teach intelligent design, we're going to teach it, but we're going to teach it as a myth. And that's kind of the title of the course, Creation is Mythology. So what I'm seeing here is a backlash. This is what I was having to deal with in Florida, is that there's a strong backlash against the intelligent design movement throughout the state of Florida, and a lot of concern that Christians in Florida are going to try to make the same moves that they've been making in Pennsylvania and in Kansas. Yeah, question. Well, what I had to deal with in Florida is making the point there's intelligent design and there's intelligent design. That's what Mark Perez was doing in his class, I bet. By the way, I think it'd be great to have Mark come here when I'm gone sometime and just tell us what he told the people there at Lake Avenue about intelligent design. That's kind of how I took it, is to say, just like there's different definitions for evolution, different definitions for creation, there are different definitions for intelligent design. And making the point that we had reasons to believe we're doing intelligent design long before there was an intelligent design movement. But the intelligent design movement is a very different strategy than we have. Their strategy is not to identify the designer, to keep things strictly religiously neutral so as not to tempt the court to apply the First Amendment of the Constitution and bar the teaching of intelligent design. Our perspective is that the Supreme Court did not bar intelligent design because it was religious. They were barring a certain brand of intelligent design, namely young earth creationism, because it had no scientific validity. In fact, as I had a chance to tell many of the groups in Florida, what we see from the Supreme Court is a statement to the effect that any explanation of the origin, history, the universe, and life is in terms of public education, regardless of theological implications, providing what is being taught has scientific integrity and credibility. It doesn't even have to have better scientific integrity and credibility in the evolutionary model. It just has to have some integrity and credibility. If it's got some that is acknowledged by the scientific community, it's in, and the theology simply doesn't matter. And the proof of that actually is what you see taking place in cosmology. If religion was a factor, the Big Bang Theory would have never gotten to first base. I mean, it's an inherently very religious model. And yet it's the dominant model in the astronomical community. It really has no competition. And it's there in spite of its theological implications because why? It's good science. It's better science than the competing models, and therefore, even though it's very offensive to Hindus and Buddhists and to Muslims and very friendly towards the Christian faith, it's in because it's got demonstrable scientific integrity and credibility. So there's an example of where the intelligent design objectives are already in place in the scientific community, but they're in place. Why? Because Big Bang theorists did not back down from identifying what that intelligent designer is, and they didn't back down because of the theological implications. Now, a lot of the scientists that are promoting it are simply naive about the specific scientific implications. But hey, according to the Supreme Court, that doesn't matter. Yes. Right. Okay, some comments on that. What I was sharing with the folks in Florida is that all scientists can see that there's design. The question is, who or what is responsible for that design? So the debate really isn't over design. I mean, if you read the scientific literature, they talk about these things inside the cell as designs. They talk about the universe having designs. However, many of the atheists that are publishing those articles don't for a minute believe that it's attributable to a god. They just say that design is an artifact of the natural process. And so there's this misconception amongst the public that the big debate is design versus no design. No, the debate really focuses on naturalistic processes producing the design as opposed to a god producing the design. And so in that sense, we're already into religious turf. You know, one group says there is no god, another group says there is a god. This is theological. The Supreme Court has basically told us in print that, yeah, theology is inevitable, but it doesn't matter. What matters is the scientific credibility of the explanation. Now, as far as Big Bang cosmology goes, a couple of books you can read to understand the theological intent of the Big Bang is a book I wrote called The Fingerprint of God, where I tell you about the history of Big Bang cosmology. And another astronomer who also wrote a book, not from a Christian perspective, from an agnostic perspective, is a book called God and the Astronomers by the Harvard astronomer Robert Jastrow. And he actually gives more detail than I give in The Fingerprint of God, but also tells the story of how the first astronomers that were beginning to discover this Big Bang model were very disturbed about it, not because of the science, but because of the theology behind it. Probably the earliest one to make that admission publicly would be Sir Arthur Eddington. Sir Arthur Eddington was a world-famous mathematical physicist. He was the one that boasted that only two people understood Einstein's theory of general relativity, himself, and he wasn't too sure about the other guy. But in the 1920s, I mean, he was as famous or more famous than Albert Einstein. He was the one that actually brought Einstein to worldwide fame, because he was the one that came up with the first experimental evidence that Einstein's theory was correct. He organized an expedition to Brazil to study the solar eclipse, and that was the first time that they were able to document that the stars' positions are different during a solar eclipse, and it's because of Einstein's theory of gravity, which says that the gravity will bend the light of the stars. And in that 1919 solar eclipse, they saw the bending of the starlight, and that's what catapulted Albert Einstein to worldwide fame. But at the time, Sir Arthur Eddington took full credit for making Albert Einstein a world-famous scientist. But he was also the one who discerned through Einstein's theory of general relativity that the universe, according to his equations, must be expanding. If it's expanding, there's a beginning. And he says a beginning is philosophically repugnant because it would demand a beginner. So he was the first to kind of lay out the theological problem with Big Bang cosmology. And you know, you'll see Robert Jastrow in his book God and the Astronomers telling the story of how the astronomical community looked at this Big Bang and said, this is theologically unacceptable. We have to find alternatives. And so the first 60 years of Big Bang cosmology history is a story of astronomers trying to find some other explanation for the universe that didn't require this beginner. And so they found things like the steady state theory. And again, you can read the original paper for the steady state theory by Sir Fred Hoyle. And in his paper, he makes the comment that, as far as he was concerned, explanations that demanded a causal agent outside of nature simply was unacceptable. And he says, that's what's wrong with Big Bang theory. Therefore, I'm proposing this new model that doesn't require an explanation outside of science to explain the universe. Likewise, the other model proposing the steady-state theory, the one by Hermann Bondi and Tommy Gold, made a similar statement in the introduction to the paper. And that's something I document in The Fingerprint of God, is that these models that were proposed to compete with Big Bang cosmology, every one of the source papers that launches the model makes a philosophical statement in the introduction, basically saying this is what's wrong with Big Bang cosmology, and this is a model that doesn't require this unacceptable God as an explanation. Now, to be more explicit, there are people today, I mean, the astronomical community today has gotten to the point where they accept the Big Bang, but it doesn't mean they're all converted, okay? They realize steady-state cosmology is a failed model. The oscillating universe model, which was put forward to also escape God by positing an infinite number of beginnings rather than just one beginning, now ranks as a failed model. And so there's a couple of other models that have been proposed. But now the astronomical community recognizes it's got to be Big Bang. However, in saying it's Big Bang, they're working hard to find some explanations for the Big Bang universe that don't require God. But again, the story we tell in the book, The Creator and the Cosmos, is that the fight to avoid God as the explanation for the Big Bang universe still goes on, but is driven by theology, not by the science. Just like the big steady-state model and the oscillating universe model, we're not driven by science. There's nothing in the science that suggests that this is a good explanation for the universe other than the theological problems with Big Bang cosmology. Likewise, today, explanations for the Big Bang that are not, quote, the standard model are done for theological reasons, not for scientific reasons. So I'd say if you want to know what the dominant one today is, the dominant one would be what's called the multiverse. You watch PBS or Discovery, and they give you a show about Big Bang cosmology, you're going to hear about the multiverse, which I would argue is simply a sophisticated revival of the oscillating universe model. The oscillating universe model is a Hindu model of the universe. The Hindus thought of it 3,000 years ago, that the universe has all kinds of beginnings that are sequential. It's the reincarnating universe theory. By the way, when I was in Florida, I ran into a bunch of Zen Buddhists and Hindus. They were all white. None of them were from India. They were American Hindus. And they were really into reincarnation. And so I got asked several times at three different events my take on reincarnation. So I said, well, reincarnation is a doctrine that comes out of the Hindu theology, Hindu cosmology in particular. And it says, if you read the Hindu Vedas, it does talk about humans reincarnating, but it's very vague and nonspecific. But where the Vedas get very specific about reincarnation is when it talks about the universe. Now it gets specific, and I would give the audience some of the details. I mean, you haven't heard about it. In the Hindu Vedas, it talks about how the universe has a beginning, grows from the beginning, and then goes through a decay phase, and ends, and then repeats, and goes through another cycle of growing and decaying, and then it has, so what it is a series of an infinite number of beginnings for the universe, beginnings and endings. And so we're in a stage of growth, which will be followed by a stage of decay, and the universe will start all over again. And the Vedas actually give you the time between each of the beginnings. It says there's exactly 4.32 billion years between one beginning of the universe and the next beginning of the universe. And the Hindu Vedas also say there's been an infinite number of these beginnings and endings going back into the past. So in that sense, there is no point of beginning for the universe, ultimate beginning. It's been there. It's eternal. It's an eternal universe with these infinite number of cycles. And, you know, with the universe reincarnating, people reincarnate too, animals or whatever. And but my appeal to the audience is here are some specific reasons from astrophysics as to why we can confidently state that everything that the Vedas say about the reincarnating universe is false. And given that we can prove that these Vedas are false about reincarnation where it's specific, then what basis do we have for understanding or believing that the Vedas might be true on reincarnation where it's non-specific? Therefore, we'd be advised not to take too seriously this idea that we humans can reincarnate. But I also gave him a little bit of insight from my perspective as a professor. One of the things I've learned as a professor is if you have a test that you give to the students where you say, look, take this test as many times as you want, students do not take the course very seriously and they don't prepare for the test very well. In fact, that's how I passed a course in German when I was at the University of Toronto. I had to have one language where I was fluent and one language where I could just read it. But the reading language, I could take the test as many times as I wanted. So did I take a course in German? No way. I just kept writing the test. And by the way, I learned a lot of German and taking the test. You know, figured out how the verb structures work and how to identify the nouns and the grammar and so forth. And eventually I passed the thing. Now, do I know German? No, of course not. I just took the test over and over again, and eventually, you know, statistics came out. I managed to pass it once. Well, that's also an argument about why we should be very skeptical about we humans reincarnating, because it'd be a terrific strategy to be employed by a supernatural being opposed to the creator of the universe. Just convince all these mini human beings on planet Earth that they can take the test as many times as they want. And they can take it as many times as they want, then they don't really have to take this life that they're living very seriously. After all, they'll be getting an infinite number of chances. And sooner or later, they're going to pass the test, and voila, they'll be in nirvana. But, well, was it nirvana? Whatever. State of nothingness. Yeah, that's the other thing. Do you really want the Hindu heaven? So, yes. Yeah, that's the other one I gave. That's Hebrews 9:27. It's given unto men once to die, then the judgment. So the Christian position is very different than the Hindu position. You get one chance. And again, my perspective as a professor, if I tell the students, you get one chance and only one chance to pass this test. If you fail this test, you'll not be allowed to take the course again. You know, they already study hard for the test. And they tend to do quite well. But if they know that they can, well, if I flunk this course, I can take the course next year, and then some of the students won't study well. Yes. That's true. I mean, you'd run into the problem of the infinite regress. I would advise you not to go push that too hard with your typical Hindu, though, because from their perspective, logic doesn't really matter. The Hindu worldview system is that, the world is illogical. There are contradictions. But again, a good way to appeal to that, incidentally, Hinduism is beginning to lose its grip on India. And it's beginning to lose its grip because India is becoming an engineering and science enterprise. And in engineering and science, you can't afford not to be logical or irrational. Well, some are. I mean, it's still true the vast majority of Indians are not that well educated and therefore aren't exposed to. But yeah, the brighter students in India are becoming, proficient in mathematics, engineering, and science. And once they do, they begin to realize reality is a system that's free of contradictions and where logic rules and the reason's important, and there's problems with the Hindu worldview. My experience in dealing with Hindus that actually were born, raised, and educated in India is that it's not that difficult to persuade them that there are problems with their Hindu religion. It's something they like already know. But keep in mind, I've been focusing on the Hindus that are typically are in college, have a college education. And, the few experiences I've had overseas is you see phenomenal responses to the Christian faith amongst those kinds of Hindus. And you'd get it just through simply telling them what they already know. For that group, exposing these contradictions about cosmic reincarnation is very effective. So, hey, anyway, I got off the point, yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I would generalize that to include Buddhism, and also generalize it that it's either telling them how to avoid suffering or how to ignore it. I mean, certain disciplines of Hinduism and Buddhism, they say, oh yeah, there's suffering. But if you go through these disciplines, you'll be able to ignore the suffering and the pain that you're experiencing, and the better you are. So it can be very ascetic. Now, young man over here. Yeah. Right, right. Well, this is a comment about the infinite regress, is that the laws of logic will tell you it's impossible to have a sequence that goes back into infinite time. From a Christian perspective, we know that time is finite. If time is finite, then there's got to be an ultimate beginning. Now, people are still trying to avoid this. By the way, this has been called the classic argument for the existence of God in philosophy. The cosmological argument, probably its most sophisticated form, is a column cosmological argument. By the way, that was invented by a Muslim. A Muslim took Augustine's idea of the cosmological argument and refined it a little bit. But how they're getting around it today is by invoking a second dimension of time. And so this is what Stephen Hawking does. He says, well, you know, if you have a second dimension of time, then you can have more than one timeline, and then you can actually not have a problem with this infinite regress, which is why we address this in the Creator and the Cosmos and say, however, our measurements on the universe tell us it really is confined to just one dimension of time, where time is finite, where it has a beginning, and therefore the column cosmological argument is a very effective argument that there must be an ultimate beginning. There must be a point where you have to have a beginner who himself has no beginning. There are a lot of scientists today on PBS that are saying they can get around the column cosmological argument, but they do it by doing things with time that physics does not permit, and the astronomical measurements don't permit. If I could say one last thing about the theology of Big Bang cosmology, if general relativity reliably describes the dynamics of the universe, and if the universe contains mass, then there's a mathematical theorem which tells us that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that creates space and time. And that is the God of the Bible. I mean, if you compare the God of the Bible to the gods of the other holy books or religions of the world, and the other holy books, and I'm talking about independent holy books, they talk about God or gods creating within space and time that always exists. Christianity is distinct in saying that God creates independent of space and time. Now, there are other religions that teach the same thing, but they do it by plagiarizing the doctrine from the Bible. And so an example would be Mormonism and Islam. But Mormonism and Islam, I would argue, are not independent religions. They are Christian cults. What both of those religions have done is to take the Old and New Testament, and through the inspiration of a so-called Latter-day Prophet, they add another book or set of books to the Old and New Testament. And therefore, we shouldn't be shocked that Mormonism teaches that there is this beginning of space and time, and likewise Islam teaches there's a beginning of space and time. And what you have to do there is show that the extra revelation in the Mormon scriptures and in the Islamic scriptures contradict what's taught in the Old and New Testament. But by the way, you will find a creation account in the Quran that reads very close to what you see in Genesis 1. But where do you think it got it from? Interesting thing about both Mormonism and Christianity is that both of those groups borrow about 25,000 words verbatim from the Bible into their latter-day revelations. So when people say, you know, do you believe that the Book of Mormon is, or that the Quran is wrong? I say, well, not all of it. Because some of it is copied right from the Bible. So it's the other parts that we critique, yes. Would I consider Catholicism a Christian cult? Well, you know, one of the churches I got to speak in Florida was an Episcopal church. And we lost one of our donors because I spoke in this Episcopal church, because that particular donor believed that the Episcopals were a cult. We did send a note back to that donor saying, well, you know, where would you rather have us speak, to the choir or to the unsaved? I mean, it turns out this is a very evangelical and conservative Episcopalian church, but even if it wasn't, I would have taken the invitation to speak. And I've done some speaking in very liberal Episcopalian churches. Now, I say that by introduction. You can pick any denomination of the Christian church, and you will find churches that are cultic, at least in my opinion. So I can show you Lutheran churches that I believe really are cultic, as I can show you an Episcopalian church. even Baptist churches. Catholics, yes. But I also know some Catholic churches where they're teaching a thoroughly evangelical and actually, by definition, a Protestant theology. So you can't go by the name on a door. There are a lot of people that avoid coming to Sierra Madre Congregational. Why? Because it's a congregational church. And so we have to explain to those people, well, we're not like the other congregational churches, or for that matter, we're not like what we used to be. This church used to be really liberal, and there were a lot of people who thought this church was, quote, cultic. But it got transformed thanks mainly to the good people over at Lake Avenue Congregational. You know, if you don't know anything about the history of this church once had 500 people attending in the 1930s. And they were very conservative, like we are today. But they wound up going liberal through the work of some pastors that they invited here, and saw their numbers decline from 500 down. It got down as low as 12. And when it hit 12, that's when they said, we think there's something wrong with our church. And so the 12 got together and said, well, you know, there's one really successful church in the Pasadena area, Lake Avenue, and they're congregational. Let's go over there and see if they can tell us what's wrong with our church. And that's when they said, well, we already know what's wrong with your church, because what the 12 did, they invited Lake Avenue to come here and do a study and help them figure out what they were doing. And they said, we already know. We don't need to do a study. In a word, you guys left out the Bible. Bring the Bible back, and you'll see. And they said, oh, that's all it takes? Bring the Bible back? Yeah, we're open to that. And so what happened was Lake Avenue took their youth man, which is Richard Anderson, and they one family, and then two single men who were preparing for ministry, they brought them over here. And Dick tells me the first time he preached in church, there were just 16 people in the church, and that included his family and this other family. But he wound up having a meeting with the 12, led all 12 to Christ, and that was the beginning of the return of this church. So, again, you can't go by the name of the church door. Well, personally, I got problems with the idea that there's a man in the church today that is infallible when he speaks ex cathedra, okay? I mean, it tells us in, by the way, a passage I read to people who are really locked into some of this Catholicism that's got cultic overtones, 2 Timothy 2:5. There is one intercessor between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. And so, yeah, I would have a problem with any Catholic who believes that there's another intercessor. But I know lots of Catholics who say, yeah, Mary, I know Mary's not the intercessor. I know the Pope's not the intercessor. I know the saints can't help us. No problem. We have had Catholics work for us at Reasons to Believe. But we do demand that they sign a doctrinal statement, and that doctrinal statement does make it very clear that you're believing that salvation is by faith alone, not through an institution or any other man. It's through faith in Jesus Christ alone. But it's been interesting to me is how many Roman Catholics are very eager to sign a doctrinal statement that reads just like the Protestant creeds. Well, Europe. And you quote evangelical polling percent. Notice in the Roman Catholic is that you have a small percentage that are thoroughly evangelical. And then you've got the vast majority, which are believing these problematic doctrines. But, you know, there's that significant minority that's really doing some great work. Incidentally, in Poland today, the Protestant community is booming. And that's what happens. What happened in Poland is that there simply was illegal to have anything except a Roman Catholic church. So during the communist era, you either were an atheist or you're a Roman Catholic. And about 99% were in the Catholic community, although a lot of them were practical atheists. Now things are different because people have a choice. And so I would make that distinction too, where people don't have a choice, then be careful. And by the way, I've seen that with Buddhists. I've run into Buddhists that have a doctrinal position that looks very much like an evangelical position, but they're in a an area where there simply is no Christian choice available to them. There is no Christian church that they can join, so they wind up having their own little sect. So again, you can't go by the name on the door. The best thing to do is just ask people what they believe and what they stand for. Okay, I was going to give you guys a quick report on what I did in Florida. Let me try to do that. I was also going to give you a scientific discovery, which I think I'm going to delay till next time. And I was going to try to finish Job 42. I can tell you right now, I'm not going to be able to get through all that. But, you know, in terms of what was going on in Florida, one thing that made it quite successful is I got interviewed by one of the big newspapers about a month before I went to Florida. And we were hoping that we'd get a little piece in the religion section of the Lakeland, Florida newspaper. And they didn't even put it in the religion section. They put it in what's called the family life section, right on the front page. And it was a very long article. And that really made a difference in the attendance we got to the events. This was a church, All Saints Episcopal, and was thoroughly evangelical. And they've been working for some time to get me. One of the things that worked, you know, in the Episcopalian churches in Florida, you don't have younger creationists. Whereas all the other churches I was working with there, they had worked hard to keep me out. In fact, there's one church in West Palm Beach. It took them 2 years to overcome the internal opposition in order for me to speak there. But Episcopalians don't have young earth creationists, so there was no problem there. And I wound up being interviewed before I spoke at the church by a guy named Reed Henserling. And he was the number two vicar in the church, but had a master's degree in geology. He was a research geologist for quite a few years. And so he wanted to know if he could do some radio shows with me. He has his very popular show. I think it's called, it's called Florida Talks with Father Reed. And well listened to. It's a talk show. And we didn't have time to do the talk show, but we did 4 half-hour tape shows. And this guy was great. I mean, never missed a beat, and packed a huge amount of content into each program. We talked about intelligent design, the intelligent design movement, the anthropic principle inequality, origin of the universe, origin of life, origin of humanity, young Earth versus old Earth, string theory, extra dimensions, and the book Beyond the Cosmos, creation theology, and even global warming got in there. So, and then we talked about a lot of things. We talked about the hurricanes and what's good about hurricanes. That always goes over well in Florida. So, the benefit of hurricanes, and especially since we're leading up to Thanksgiving, how do we can thank God for designing hurricanes just right? Never mind all these. By the way, you drive through Florida, I mean, there's no mountains. I mean, it's as flat as a pancake. And you drive around there, and you wonder, you know, if a hurricane comes through here, there's nothing to stop it. I mean, it just goes right through. And some of the worst damage from Hurricane Wilma was not on the coast. There was one town right in the middle of Florida that was virtually wiped out to the ground, and the cities around it were fine. So hurricanes can do that. But we did those interviews, and then there was a dinner, and during the dinner they made me talk. We had a Q&A time during the dinner. It's the first time I've done a Q&A before I even had a chance to speak. This church was very well prepared. They had shown this DVD several times before I showed up, and so the church was very supportive, and the place was packed out. I mean, they had an overflow room, and they had about 100 people standing outside the church trying to listen. And they asked me to speak first on a Christian critique of the intelligent design movement, and then talk about the scientific evidence for Christ as a designer. And it was a great setup. You know, what's wrong with ID is that it doesn't identify the designer. When you do identify the designer, you get a creation model that's very effective. We had a lot of non-Christians there. But what was exciting about this church, as soon as I left, they launched follow-up classes taught by our volunteer apologists. So kind of what you have Mark Perez doing, we had people there that were launching classes after we left. I spoke at Southeastern University. That's the fastest growing university in the state of Florida. And it's evangelical. And they're getting all kinds of non-Christians attending because of the excitement of all the new buildings and programs that are there. And I got to speak to two religion classes and a physics class. They had them all together in one group. And I talked about Genesis and science as their problem. The Christians there were predominantly young Earth, that they had never heard our perspective before. And I can tell you there was no real opposition to the physics. They just said, this is different, we've never heard it before. And this was very exciting to them. The president was beaming. He says, I've been trying to make this kind of thing happen on this campus for a long time. So I wound up having a lunch with the president and a lot of the science faculty, administrative officials. But I didn't know this, is that the main TV news program, they had their people there, and they were filming during my lecture. And afterwards, they got a lot of the students on camera and asked for their perspective. And mainly what the guy got was young Earth creationists saying that based on the message, they have a whole new perspective on creation theology in the Bible. And how exciting was that? And then he wound up interviewing me for about 5 minutes, and that went on the evening news. And that really helped the rest of our events. Fort Myers, we went to three places, Lakeland, Fort Myers, and West Palm Beach. And with Fort Myers, we're mainly meeting with our chapter leaders. We got 5 new chapters starting in the state of Florida. So that's really exciting. People are going to go out and speak and teach and spread the reasons to believe message. And what was really fun is we had a dinner with some of these chapter leaders. And what often I notice is you've got couples where the husband is really excited about reasons to believe and the wife is barely tolerating it. But we had this dinner, and these wives surrounded me first, and they said, we wake up in the morning listening to you, and we go to sleep at night listening to you. And you're breaking up our marriage and all this kind of stuff. But over the course of the dinner, these ladies really got excited. I had Kathy with me. She was traveling with me. And so she got to talk to the ladies while I talked to the men. And bottom line was every one of these ladies decided they would go with their husbands over to West Palm Beach to hear all the events. I was speaking 10 times in West Palm Beach. And this one lady said, yeah, I'll go to one, and then we'll go home. And that's what the husband agreed to. He really wanted to go to all 10, but he says, look, to get my wife to go, I'll go to just one. But once she got to West Palm Beach, he says, no, I want to hear the rest of this. And all of these ladies are really excited about the ministry now. And in fact, the husband's talked to me and said, this is scary. They're more excited than we are. So, but again, it just took some exposure. They just needed to have some face-to-face exposure. And I credit Kathy with a reason for a lot of success of making that happen. West Palm Beach, there was a church there called Memorial Presbyterian, and the pastors there have been trying to get us to come for years, a lot longer than just 2 years. They told me they had a 2-year battle to get us to come to the church. And what they realized as pastors of this Presbyterian church is that, by the way, West Palm Beach is a very wealthy area. It's kind of like Beverly Hills and Manhattan put together on the beach. This is where you got the Donald Trump Towers and all that kind of stuff. And who lives there? It's mainly professionals that live there. So you've got engineers, scientists, doctors, lawyers, and a lot of business executives live there. And these pastors have figured out some time ago that traditional ministry was not going to reach these non-Christians. It was going to take the reasons to believe message. So we said, we've been following you for over 5 years, and we're trying to figure out some way to get your material into our church so we could reach these people. Because what we've been noticing is we've been growing our church through Christians transferring. And our goal has been Florida's Bible Belt country. And so, but what happened is I got to meet the lady that led the movement to keep me out of the church. So, I had no idea who she was. By the way, I did offer to go there ahead of time to try to deal with this group because I heard about the trouble. And the pastor says, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. And they got me out there. And what they just did is, they just showed these DVDs. We got 4 DVDs now. And so they were showing these things. We have several DVDs that deal with the young Earth, old Earth issue. But this one lady came up to me at the very end after the 10 messages and said, I'm the one who led the committee to stop you from coming. And there were about 24 of us. And we did things like threaten to withdraw financial support for the church and You know, we really tried to make life miserable for our pastors. We regret doing all that now. And the entire group met with me and said they'd done a 180. They'd completely turned around. And they said that our presumption was that Reasons to Believe was trying to reach scientists for Christ by compromising on the science and compromising on the Bible. That was our belief. They said we just had no idea that, said we even doubted your salvation. We weren't sure you guys were Christians. And then she said, you know, the thing that really made me say, okay, we can bring this guy in, says our pastor showed this thing about six times. And says, you know, just watching Journey Toward Creation, she says, you know, it seems like these people really do care about people coming to faith in Christ. And they also could see the passion we had to use science as a tool to bring people to Christ. Then she also saw this thing, Cosmic Fingerprints, where I give my testimony at Willow Creek Community Church. And says that's what persuaded her that, gee, maybe Hugh Ross really is a Christian. And she was only planning to go to the first event, but she wound up going to all 10. And said, this is just so exciting. And says, the thing that really transformed me is realizing from an old earth perspective, you have far more evidence that God is the creator than you do from a young earth perspective. And you've got far more tools to reach people for Christ. So she says, you can count me as an excited, enthusiastic supporter from now on. That was true of the rest of her committee. And the pastor was standing beside me and said, I knew this was going to happen. I just knew this was going to happen. So that was fun. So, and the other thing is, this church was really exciting for me because they do a thing called the courtyard, which means every Saturday night, because right next to, it's a big downtown university. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's escaped me right now, but they're literally just one block from a really big university. And they do this thing called the courtyard where they invite the students and the faculty from the university to come. And it's basically what they call a skeptics forum free-for-all. You speak for 5 minutes and then you let the skeptics take over. So it's a lot like our skeptics forum, but they've been doing it for some time, but typically using philosophy as a tool for working with the skeptics, and they've never been able to use the science, so we kind of used a science approach, and it was very exciting and fun. It was raining, but people stayed in the rain. It's just like, it's warm rain there, at least it was when we were there. So that was really good. So that was Florida. I have much longer report here, but I'm going to cut it in view of the time here. And what I want to talk about in terms of Job 42. Oh, and by the way, we just finished this study on bad designs in nature. I've got a lot more to say about bad designs in nature, but I think I'm going to move on and get us into Job 42. But that was really the whole focal point of this skeptics forum, this thing in the courtyard, is these professors and students. They had about a dozen of them they wanted to discuss, saying, you know, this is our evidence that Christianity can't be really true, these bad designs in nature. So I had to talk about things why tonsils are good for us, because some of them were convinced that tonsils were a bad design of the human body. And we talked about the tailbone and the inverted retina and the appendix. But going through a whole bunch of these, they eventually kind of figured it out. Okay. These are things we think are bad designs, but they're simply designs that we haven't studied well enough to see why they're good designs. And all the examples of bad designs we see in nature, as we pointed out here in the class, are in those arenas where things are really so complex we can't claim complete understanding. But hey, I'm old enough to remember when the doctors would go through our public school and about two-thirds of the kids in our public school got their tonsils taken out, because there was this belief that tonsils were bad designs. I still got my tonsils, but my sisters don't have their tonsils. They were in that group that was shuffled off to the hospital and got their tonsils taken out. I managed to escape that for some reason. I think it's because I only had one cold over the course of the past 12 months. My sisters had two, and they said, two's too many. Here you go. And so they had to go to the hospital. But they got to eat ice cream for a while, so they were kind of happy about that. So, but it was interesting how that what we've been studying here in the class was really apropos for exactly what's happening on the university campuses. But there seems to be that the thing I'm seeing is that there's this focus on bad designs in nature, and there's this bashing of intelligent design that's trying to persuade people that Christianity is not really the way to go. So I'm all convinced more than ever that our new book on our testable creation model is really critical for giving Christians an alternative. And that's what I faced there in Florida, with these Christians thinking they're stuck between a rock and a hard place in terms of the Christian faith. You either go with young earth, where you got a model, but the model's a failed model, or you go with intelligent design, where there is no model. And either way, you're getting beat up by the press, by the media, and by the scientific community. And it's like they had no idea that there was another way to approach Christianity and science. So that explains why they had such an enthusiastic reaction. They'd never heard of us before. When they had, they got very excited because they saw that it offered that alternative. Okay, Job 42. I got a couple of minutes in which we can set things up. We'll finish this next week. I'm here until April, and here until January, so we should be able to move progress and jump into the Psalms and the creation accounts in the Psalms. And that the critical thing for Job 42 is to recognize that the last couple of verses of Job 41 really give you the intro to Job 42. It's really talking about the Leviathan. Nothing on earth is his equal, a creature without fear. He looks down on all that are haughty. He is king over all that are proud. And then it kind of launches you into Job 42, where God addresses how he ministers to the prideful, and how he's going to use Job in ministering to his prideful friends. Again, just to give you a point of review, Job 38 deals with the physical part of creation, Job 39, 40, and 41, the soulish part, and then Job 42, the spiritual part. So in that sense, you've got a parallel what you have in Genesis chapter 1. God first deals with the physical creation in Genesis chapter 1, then the soulish creation, creation days 5 and 6, and finally with the spirit creation. Genesis chapter 2 follows the same pattern. It has Adam introduced first to the physical creation, then the soulish creation, and last of all, that one creature that God created on earth, that's body, soul, and spirit. And likewise, we see here in the book of Job, physical creation first, soulish creation, and then the spirit creation. Next week, what I want to do is entertain any questions or comments you've got about the behemoth and Leviathan, why this is here. We've actually taught on this in the class before, but some people asked me if we could do kind of a quick overview of that. We can do that. So if you got any questions on that, you can bring that next time. But I think it was, about 6 months ago that we did our little study in Job 40 and 41 on Leviathan and the behemoth and the controversy that's raging in the Christian community over that. But it's really an example of two of these soulish creatures, and really addressing the question of the human, just how terrifying these creatures are for humans, and using an introduction for God dealing with human pride. Because we see in the beginning of Job 40 that God addresses pride, the pride of humanity, and how God tames human pride. And then Job 42 is an explanation of how God dealt with the pride of Job and his friends in the course of this long debate that takes place, an interesting debate on science and faith and many other issues. And we notice how easily Job repents of his pride, and then God uses Job to pray for his four friends. So I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. And really look at verse 2. I know you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. What Job is really conceding there is that everything that happened to him was under God's control. Nothing happened outside God's control. All the suffering and calamity experience, he confesses, was by the hand of God, and therefore to purpose. And he was now trusting that God would fulfill that purpose. Then the epilogue, we see the purpose that God fulfills through Job. And Job ministers to his friends, but Job is not just ministering to his friends, he's ministering to future generations. Then he explains how God blessed Job because of his response to the calamity and the suffering he put him through. So if you're going to go through a lot of calamity and suffering, God's in it, and God's going to bring out a great reward as a result of it. You got a last comment you want to make? Yeah, and I think they can get it on our website too, and it's downloadable, so people want that. In fact, I believe you can get the entire funeral service. I wasn't the only one that spoke there. Jim Tour spoke there as well, the lifelong friend of Rick Smalley, who is a converted Jew, and also the pastor of Second Baptist, Ben Young, got to speak. So you can get the tape or the written remarks. Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, as we approach the end of our study in the book of Job, Father, I pray you would help us to gain any insights that you'd like us to discern from this text. And Lord, thank you for the richness of the apologetic insights we've seen in here, and I pray you would help us to use these effectively to bring other people to faith in Jesus Christ. And as we move into the creation accounts in the Psalms, Lord, help us to be able to integrate what we've learned in the book of Job with what we're going to be learning in the Psalms. Help us to see that these two poetic accounts of creation really do work hand in hand. So, Father, I pray you'd help all of us to remember what we've learned in the book of Job and to apply that as we jump into our study in the Psalms. In Jesus' name, amen.